I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. It looks like retail sales for the holiday season, the six critical weeks between Thanksgiving and New Year's, were up, and they can be make or break for many stores. We're told that consumer spending is the most important factor in the U.S. economy, accounting for about 70% of economic activity. But that has come with a price, high levels of personal debt. For instance, the average credit card debt per household today is about $16,000. Sheldon Guerin writes in his new book, Beyond Our Means, that until after World War II, the U.S. was largely a nation of savers. That began to change several generations ago and went into high gear in the 1980s, when personal debt began to rise and the savings rate fell. Guerin's book is subtitled Why America Spends While the World Saves, our topic for today's Radio Times. He's a professor of history and East Asian studies at Princeton University, joins us from their studios. And Sheldon Guerin, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's great to be on the show again.
Nice to have you on the show again. Are Americans bigger shoppers compared to their European counterparts?
Yes, incredibly so. If we look at most of the core economies of continental Europe, Germany, France, Belgium, Austria, Sweden, they all have saving rates above 10%. They have for the last 30 years. Consumption is at a fraction of the U.S., perhaps about 70 to 75% of consumption levels would be the typical for Germans or French compared to the U.S. So the U.S. is really in a league of its own.
But we are told that our economy depends on consumer spending, that if we spend, companies will hire people and that will get people back to work. Are you challenging that?
Well, I'm not challenging that. Clearly, consumer spending, as you say, is a huge part of the economy. But as you also said, households have to spend in a way that's within their means and that doesn't so destabilize their finances that they're incapable of spending in the future. And that's where we are right now. People are tapped out. They're over-indebted from housing, from credit card debt, and they can't really jumpstart the economy the way it needs to be now because of an excess.
And what is the typical savings rate in this country?
Well, typical is a difficult word here. We fluctuated. But since the early 1990s, when it was about 7%, we have fallen down to nearly zero by 2005. In the panic that followed 2008, people began what's called precautionary saving. Our savings rate on an annual basis went up to somewhere between 5 to 6%. But now it's trending quite down, and the last few months have been under 4%, about 3.5%. It's a very low saving rate.
And then comparing us, as you say, to Germany, Sweden, France, Australia, Belgium, their savings rate is what, 10 to 13%?
That's right. Actually, Austria, not Australia.
Oh, yes, Austria, of course. but 10 to 13%, which is dramatically more savings.
It is. And while we tend to focus on the Chinese or the Japanese before them, who had very high savings rates in the 20% range, the fact is that the Germans, the French, and others, these big economies, have held the savings rate for the last 30 years above 10%.
And how do they do that?
Well, they do it in two ways. Their governments for the past 200 years have promoted what's called small saving. In other words, they set up a series of financial institutions called savings banks and post office savings banks that make it very easy for lower-income people, the small saver, to come in with very little money. There are no fees. There are no minimum balances. So they've been very accessible to the entire population. That's one way they've done it. The other way they've done it is they've actually been much more stringent on regulating credit, whether it's consumer credit or housing credit, than we have. In the 1980s, which in our country occasioned deregulation of the financial institutions and the profusion of credit cards and home equity loans and subprime mortgages and things like that, we don't see the equivalent in the economies of continental Europe. Indeed, they have actual policies to protect their citizens from what they call over-indebtedness, a term that doesn't even exist in our country.
Indeed. In fact, you say that credit cards in Europe are really more like the kind of debit cards we use in this country. Can you expand on that?
Sure. Typically, Europeans think they have credit cards, and it's always amusing to go out to dinner with them and ask them what their card is, because it has Visa or MasterCard on it. But it really is what's called a delayed debit card. It's hooked into their bank accounts, typically, in almost all cases, so that you... directly out of your saving or checking account. The money flows directly into pay the monthly bill. You are expected to pay your monthly bill in full. You might get some sort of overdraft of 1,000 or 3,000 euros, but within 30 days, you have to pay it in full. It comes out of your account. And if you don't, no more credit.
Very different from the way it is in this country. Now, I was looking up some information yesterday, credit card debt per household in the U.S., about $16,000. I think for individuals, it's closer to, let's say, $5,000, which is dramatically different from our European counterparts.
It certainly is. I mean, when you try and explain to a continental European that you can borrow against your credit card, they are incredulous. It simply can't be done. I had an interview with a savings banker in Western Germany, and I asked him about these delayed debit cards. And what happens if somebody really does charge more than they have? And they say, well, then we suggest to them maybe it's time to give back your credit card.
Oh, wow.
Totally different approach.
You also make the point, which is interesting, that in Europe, where in many ways they have a social safety net that's bigger than ours, provides for health care, for retirement, for education. And yet with all those benefits, there still is this high savings rate.
Yes, and this confuses economists who are educated in America, because it's a standard model in American economics departments that welfare, generous welfare benefits, particularly national pensions, what we call Social Security, economists argue that these should act to depress saving. Mm-hmm. Instead, in Europe, it seems to do exactly the opposite. We live in a country with rather flimsy safety nets. One would think that life is very risky here and people would save up. Europeans live in a much more secure environment. One would think they would save less, but we see exactly the opposite. Now, why might that be? Well, a welfare state in Europe does something that we really don't do. It keeps most of its population from falling into poverty and distress. Simply by keeping people in stable middle-class situations, you automatically increase your saving rate. Whereas in our country, so many people have fallen through the cracks that they find that whereas in Europe, if you're in trouble, you get welfare. In America, when you're in trouble, we give you more credit. So people get over their heads in this country in debt, and therefore our saving rate goes down. So I think actually welfare states tend to promote saving rather than the other way around.
Which seems counterintuitive until you begin to actually think about it. There's an article in today's New York Times about consumers and the sluggish economy as it's described. And one of the explanations is that incomes are essentially flat. Job growth has been modest. More than 40% of the new jobs in the last 2 years have been low-paying sectors like retail and hospitality. If Americans were, though, making more money, would they be able to save more money?
Well, they should be able to. The problem is our institutions promote consumption and credit so heavily that if Americans made more money, they probably would spend almost all of it. Whereas in other countries, when income goes up, typically saving rate goes up because people tend to save a good portion of that.
You mentioned the 1980s and the way you write about it. Seems like this was a turning point for this country when it came to savings and debt. What happened in the 1980s?
Well, in very simple terms, we see the massive deregulation of financial institutions. But let's back up. Before 1980, very few Americans had credit cards. It was mainly the affluent. After 1980, the credit card industry became deregulated. Credit cards, as a result of a Supreme Court decision, could charge any interest they wanted on unpaid balances. And they began to charge these 18% rates, 30% rates. There's virtually no regulation. And because it was such a profit-making enterprise, credit card companies specifically targeted what they at the time called subprime customers. Mm. Customers with shaky finances, but they thought they might be able to pay them back. Home equity loans did not exist before the mid-1980s, but a 1986 tax reform law made the home equity loan the only thing other than a mortgage that was tax deductible. All of a sudden, home equity loans exploded. And so these things, home equity loans, credit cards that we didn't really have before, all of a sudden became very easy to get money that people didn't have.
In fact, you also say that we begin to see in the 1980s stagnant household incomes, especially for middle and moderate income families.
That's right, and that's where credit becomes our welfare policy. People have stagnant incomes, but they're trying to keep up or even increase their consumption. They're trying to buy bigger houses. They're trying to stay in a housing market that's exploding in the 1990s. And as a result, they begin to paper over the fact that their incomes are stagnant by borrowing more and more and temporarily thinking themselves fairly affluent.
And that takes us to where we are today.
That's right.
And are we at a point at which we have to begin to make some serious decisions and have some serious discussions about this balance between savings and spending?
Precisely. I mean, this is the sort of discussion we're not seeing. We just went through the Christmas shopping season when I was on several programs, and people thought it was heretical to talk about balancing saving and consumption or to even mention the word saving. But we are at the point where we need to have these painful discussions. Most Americans cannot live at the level they did in the last 10 years, and they are going to have to retrench to some extent, and they're going to have to increase their saving so that they have some margin and some independence in life. It's not an easy thing for Americans to think about. We were told this was not part of the American dream, but it looks like most countries, that there are limits to how much we can spend when we don't actually have the money, and saving will become quite important.
And even this idea of opening small savings accounts, I mean, I remember things like that as a kid growing up.
Exactly. And it's interesting that as our financial industry became more and more reckless and more independent of supervision, they also became more and more antisocial. They didn't really particularly see themselves as promoting small saving anymore, which had been a historical mission of many of these banks. So all of a sudden, you have these high minimum balances, you have fees. In this country today, among the lowest income quintile, 25% of them are what's called unbanked. They do not have bank accounts. It's not because they're unthrifty. It's because the banks have made themselves very unfriendly by having these high barriers, high fees, high minimum balances.
And we're almost up on a break here. And these tend to be, what, poor people and perhaps go to a payday lender or something in order to get money, which, of course, is very expensive.
Exactly. By turning these people away from banks, they indeed have to depend on this non-banking, totally unregulated market of check cashing services, payday loans, at exorbitant interest rates and exorbitant fees. And this, of course, further impoverishes them.
And gets it harder and harder to get out of debt.
Exactly.
That's Sheldon Guerin, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about how and why we need to save more, the subject of his new book. It's called Beyond Our Means, Why America Spends While the World Saves. He's a professor of history and East Asian studies at Princeton University, joins us from their studios, and we'd like to hear from you. Are you able to save money on the salary that you have? Give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Violette DeMazia Foundation supports WHYY. Are you an art lover? The Violette DeMazia Foundation teaches ways to appreciate works of art wherever you may encounter them. Registration is now open for a variety of programs focusing on visual art at various locations, including the Philadelphia Museum of Art, Chester County Historical Society, and the Wayne Art Center. Classes are appropriate for anyone interested in discovering a different way to see art and life. Registration at www.demazia.org.
This week in This American Life, at an apartment complex in New Hampshire, tenants' dogs were leaving doggy waste everywhere until the property manager took action.
When one of my maintenance guys is walking through the door, he knows exactly what he'll be doing when he hears this.
What he'll be doing is taking a DNA sample of the errant poo this week.
Tomorrow night at 9 on WHYY.
The Republican candidates for president have spent months going up and down in the polls, sparring on debate stages across the country, giving countless stump speeches, all before a single vote has been cast. I'm Mara Liasson. Later today, NPR News will bring you results, reaction, and analysis from the first presidential contest of the year. Join us for live coverage of the Iowa caucuses from NPR News.
tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are talking about why America spends while the world saves. Our guest Sheldon Guerin's book is titled Beyond Our Means, and that's the subtitle. He's a professor of history and East Asian studies at Princeton University, joining us from their studios. And we have calls coming in to 1-888-477-9499. Let me take advantage of your history expertise. I'm talking to you from Philadelphia, of course, the home of Benjamin Franklin, who famously said, "A penny saved is a penny earned." Looking at U.S. history, do we have a history of savings and thinking about savings as a good sort of patriotic thing to do?
Well, we do, and certainly Franklin is the patron saint of this. In some ways, in the 19th century, Franklin was much more popular in Europe than he was in his own country when it came to thrift. He actually, friends of his in France and Britain went on to found the first savings banks in the early 1800s. So, but we certainly participated as Americans in this transnational discourse of promoting thrift and saving in the 19th century. We set up saving banks in places like Philadelphia and Boston and New York. And so we were doing more or less what the Europeans were doing. Except that we weren't doing it quite as evenly as the Europeans were doing. Things like saving banks, which were very good for promoting saving in the 19th century, they were very dense in New England and the mid-Atlantic states, places like Philadelphia, but they didn't extend much to the rest of the country, particularly in the southern and western states. So as late as 1910, most Americans didn't have access to any sort of savings institution whatsoever. And of course, this discouraged saving. So we've had the value, we've had the virtue of thrift, but institutionally, often we've been behind the Europeans and later the Japanese in terms of promoting saving on an equal, even basis across our nation.
I'm curious, too, about the 20th century. Of course, you have two world wars, World War I and World War II, and the Depression. How did that influence people's thinking about savings or even their actions about savings?
It had enormous influence because, we came into World War I quite late in the last year and a half. And so we weren't as mobilized as the Europeans were. But nonetheless, we mounted these European-style savings campaigns in World War I. But it was particularly World War II when the U.S. government actively got in the business of promoting small saving. Of course, the reason was clear. You wanted to raise enough saving to finance the war. But the big innovation in World War II was the U.S. savings bond, which actually originated in 1935 in the Depression, but really caught on during World War II, so that all of a sudden, all across the country, in banks, schools, post offices, you could buy these low-denomination savings bonds. And this really encouraged small saving. And then after the war, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, FDIC, which had been created in 1934 in response to the Depression, but didn't have a lot of influence in the 30s, but all of a sudden this really kicked in 1945. People had a lot of savings, and it meant they could go to their local banks, and they could now be assured their banks would not fail, or if their banks did fail, they wouldn't lose their deposits. So between savings bonds and FDIC, we saw a real profusion of small saving during World War II and in the decade or two after World War II. Americans were very good savers during that period.
I'm thinking if you know anyone, and I certainly do, people who lived through the Depression, whether parents or grandparents, very conscious about how much money they saved, turning off lights when they left a room, cutting coupons, looking for all those particular kind of sales, a mentality or a psychology that grew out of that difficult time.
It's true, and we talk a lot about the Depression molding behavior, and there's some truth to that. But more than that, it was the U.S. government and its institutions reinforcing this behavior. In a sense, people became great savers not during the Depression, but during the wartime and post-war when they had prosperity, but they had these institutions that made it so easy to save.
I remember going to the school and going to public school in the 1950s and, bringing my dollar to school to put in a savings account.
Exactly. I mean, we haven't talked about that yet, but these so-called school savings banks were an innovation in Europe in the late 19th century. They spread to some parts of the U.S., Particularly spread during World War II with the savings bond and the early post-war period, which we're talking about. Mm-hmm. And I, too, went through a program like this. And now we have very few of these school savings programs. There is an attempt to modernize them. They're called financial education now. Some schools adopt them today. Most schools do not. But clearly there's a need to reintroduce this financial education that makes our citizens financially literate. Not just about saving, but about credit.
You include a press conference that President Eisenhower had in April 9th, 1958. The question of the president was, Mr. President, I'd like to ask you a question about what people should do to make the recession recede. This is the 1950s. The president says, buy. The question is, the questioner says, buy what? And President Eisenhower says, buy anything. That sounds so familiar, doesn't it?
It does, and that's why I started that chapter, because it does sound so much like the present. But the reason I introduced that is that was a new idea in the 1950s, that rather than saving an investment, that the U.S. economy should be encouraging primarily consumption, and consumption based on credit as the driver of the economy. This was a U.S. innovation, not seen much in Japan or continental Europe. And it gives us what we have today, which is there's a sort of an unquestioning assumption that buying anything is the best thing we can do. Now, in the 1950s, it made sense. If you bought something, it was probably made in the United States. So it had a huge multiplier effect on creating and maintaining jobs. Today, when we buy, we're buying things made in China. Our workers don't see the benefit of it. We buy it at Christmas time from retail stores where people are hired as temporary employees at very low wages with no health benefits. So the effects of our consumer spending probably are not what they once were after World War II, and yet we keep saying this.
Well, and many people will refer back to this time, a time when the middle class developed and the country was really booming, as an example of what to do to fix our problems today.
They do. It's going to be very difficult, of course, to go back to that. But we do have to think of ways, and this goes way beyond saving, of revitalizing a middle class where people are employed, they're employed in good jobs, they have benefits. If we don't go back to at least some sort of relative equality, it's going to be very difficult to keep this consumer economy going.
Well, and let me ask you another question. We do want to get to our callers. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been put into place. Is there anything in there you think that will encourage the kinds of things you've been talking about?
Well, I think it could. This is sweeping legislation, and the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has sweeping powers, particularly to regulate predatory lending, to introduce transparency and things like credit card contracts and things like that. It also even has a mandate to promote financial education around the country. The problem is, at this point, the Bureau is hamstrung by politics. The Republican Party and allies in Wall Street are doing what they can to cripple it. It does not yet have a director, and without a director, it apparently lacks the legal powers to do much of the enforcement of these things. So it could be very significant, but so far it is not.
And that's Sheldon Guerin, our guest today on Radio Times, the author of a book called Beyond Our Means, Why America Spends While the World Saves. He's a professor of history and East Asian studies at Princeton University, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We're curious whether you make enough money to save or what would inspire you to save money. Do give us a call. Let's see what Ann from Ardmore has to say. And Ann, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm 69 years old. I've been retired for 7 years as of this week. And I find that the only thing I'm able to save for is a tax bill that comes due in the middle of February. So as soon as March comes around, I start plunking my $135 a month into a savings account or into a checking account that's just for that. I live from pension check and Social Security check to the next set because there's no squeeze room, and I'm not profligate. I pay my mortgage, I pay my utilities, I pay my health insurance, I eat. I'm comfortable, but I'm not wealthy, and I can only measure myself against third world people when I'm considering how wealthy I am, because considering many people my age whom I know in the Philadelphia area and beyond, I'm poor.
Mm. Well, and let me see what Sheldon Guerin has to say. And here's someone who is taking steps to try to be responsible, but she feels poor.
Well, it's not surprising. I mean, Anne's situation is actually quite typical. You know, we Americans imagine ourselves to be much richer than we actually are. Median income household income has fallen. It's fallen below $50,000. And one has to think about in our country, where we don't have much of a welfare state, we have to pay for our health insurance, as Anne says. We have to pay for education for our children, particularly in the higher levels. We have to pay a lot out of that fairly low income. And it indeed is quite difficult to save when we think of how many things we have to consume, spend on that that people in Europe do not.
And these are basic things, as she was describing, things like food and rent and making sure you pay your taxes.
No, exactly.
And just to underscore what you said, and it's come up on other shows on Radio Times, that the median household income in this country is a little less than $50,000.
That's right.
That's not a lot of money for a household.
It's not. And now, of course, it depends what region you're in. Some places it goes further, but certainly on the East Coast where we are, it doesn't go very far.
Let me see what looks like Sean from Bethlehem has to say. And Sean, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi there. I just wanted to say that I actually am able to save a little bit. I'm 26. I've been at my job currently for about 6 months. And I've used some new techniques that I've actually learned from watching TV shows and some movies. I've been using couponing, and something new I started recently from a documentary I watched, dumpster diving.
Which is literally jumping into dumpsters and seeing what you can find in there, Sean.
Yeah, especially now at the winter time, it's easy to find a lot of stuff that's still in decent shape, a lot of meats and whatnot. They don't go bad because it's so cold out. And I've actually done it a few times so far, and been able to find some good stuff.
Well, and I'm worried, I have to say, Sean, about jumping into dumpsters and pulling out meat that might be in there. But Sheldon Guerin, you know, you can't build an economy on people dumpster diving. Can you?
Certainly not.
Can you?
No, it's not one of my policy recommendations.
No, it isn't. I noticed that.
However, Sean has a good point, and I think in other respects, what Sean is doing is quite commendable, which is it's very important to start the savings habit when you're young and when you get your first job. It's very important not to simply say, well, if things are going to go well for me, I'll spend what I have now and I'll save later. It's very important for young people to build up a store of saving, to get in the habit, and the money they build up actually by the time they are in their 60s, if they keep doing that, they may find they have a lot more comfort and independence than other people exactly the same income who didn't do that. So I think economizing is important when you're young, short of dumpster diving.
Short of dumpster diving, Sean. Be careful out there. Let me ask you, though, Sheldon Guerin, and it seems like companies, if they are helping their employees save a retirement, are shifting from pensions to 401ks. What do you make of that trend?
Well, it's a disturbing trend in many ways. It fits with the current American ethos of personal responsibility, that you're on your own, you make your decisions. What has happened, of course, is that Americans were left with this choice. Do they want to contribute to 401ks or not? Do they even get the 401k from their employers? A lot of employers do not do that. Do their employers match their contributions? Some do, some don't. What has happened, I think, with this experiment of the 401k, which is now about 30 years old, is that it's tended to benefit affluent earners, the sort of people who probably would have saved already. We give a much bigger tax break to the affluent for saving, because we do it according to tax brackets. If you're in the 33 or 35% bracket, you get a lot. If you're a lower income person, you really don't get anything in terms of taxes for saving. So we haven't set very good incentives for retirement saving. We've also, I think, exposed a lot of wage earners to more risk than they perhaps understand. Many of them put it into stocks, and then they found stock market was very volatile. They don't have what they thought they had.
Let me get Megan from Chester County to join us on Radio Times. Megan, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Marty, I'm a big fan, and
thanks.
I'm a member of WHYY.
Good for
thanks
you.
Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for being a member.
I wanted to share something from two different perspectives, and I do have a question.
Sure.
I used to live in Austria for 10 years, and I found that the positive thought process behind saving was really, I'm going to retire and travel the world, or I'm going to do something with my savings. And here, it seems to me that people save for that rainy day catastrophe, and it's a very negative reason for saving, and they just don't want to do it.
Well, that's an interesting way of looking at it. Let me see what Sheldon Guerin has to say. Does that make sense to you, Sheldon?
It makes total sense. We actually have a lot of data from places like Germany and Austria where people are asked, why do they save? And Americans, as she said, will say, we're saving for retirement. We're saving for the rainy day. Central Europeans will tend to say, I am saving up to consume on something. Either to buy a house later on or for a vacation, exactly as she says. And so these two words, saving up, which used to be part of the American vocabulary, have disappeared. One does not save up to consume in this country. One simply borrows to consume. Either you take your home equity loan or you put it on your credit card. But we don't have this positive notion that you can save for other things other than rainy days and retirement. And I think we need to get that back because in practice, that's in fact what people do.
But do you think it is a kind of psychology in this country, perhaps a psychology that is reinforced by policies?
Well, it very much is. I mean, again, thinking about retirement, we have one tax advantage for saving in this country. Other countries have tax advantages if you open a small savers account in places like France and in Germany, used to be in Japan. In this country, the only tax advantage you get is saving for retirement. It really makes no sense because in the real world, people need to save up for short-term needs, either to consume, to buy a house, or perhaps for an emergency, a car repair in the next few days. And we don't do anything to incentivize that sort of saving in our country.
One of the things that Megan didn't have a chance to say, and I'm just seeing on the computer here, is that houses are smaller in Europe. Does that also help Europeans to live more within their means?
Very much. And in fact, in my book, I talk about comparing American house size with European and Japanese house size. It's extraordinary, the difference, how, again, America is in a league of its own. We actually have very good data on what the average size of a new house is.
Mm-hmm.
We've had this data since 1950. In 1950, GIs came back from the war, and they bought these two-room bungalows. They were about 950 square feet. That was the average size of a new house in 1950. After the year 2000, the average size of an American house went up to 2,500 square feet.
Wow.
It's a little bit lower now. It's about 2,300. Now, if you compare that to Europeans, the Germans might be about 1,200 square feet, about half the size. Italians are about 850 square feet. Japanese about 1,000. The Americans, in other words, have houses at least twice as large. And this leads to putting a lot more in the houses, more stuff, more consumption.
And that's Sheldon Guerin, our guest today on Radio Times, author of Beyond Our Means, Why America Spends While the World Saves. We'll take another short break and then get back to our conversation and to our callers as well. Are you able to save money? Give us a call. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
The Violette DeMazia Foundation supports WHYY. Are you an art lover? The Violette DeMazia Foundation teaches ways to appreciate works of art wherever you may encounter them. Registration is now open for a variety of programs focusing on visual art at various locations, including the Philadelphia Museum of Art, Chester County Historical Society, and the Wayne Art Center. Classes are appropriate for anyone interested in discovering a different way to see art and life. Registration at www.demazia.org.
This week in This American Life, at an apartment complex in New Hampshire, tenants' dogs were leaving doggy waste everywhere until the property manager took action.
When one of my maintenance guys is walking through the door, he knows exactly what he'll be doing when he hears this.
What he'll be doing is taking a DNA sample of the errant poo this week.
Tomorrow night at 9 on WHYY.
Republican candidates for president have spent months going up and down in the polls, sparring on debate stages across the country, giving countless stump speeches, all before a single vote has been cast. I'm Mara Liasson. Later today, NPR News will bring you results, reaction, and analysis from the first presidential contest of the year. Join us for live coverage of the Iowa caucuses from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. The country's economic health depends on consumer spending, or so we're told. So it follows that buying things will improve the economy and get more people back to work. The problem is that millions of Americans are struggling with debt with little or no savings. We're talking about how this happened and what can be done to increase the savings rate and what we can learn from other developed countries about this balance between saving and spending. And again, our guest is Sheldon Guerin, author of Beyond Our Means, Why America Spends While the World Saves, professor of history and East Asian studies at Princeton University. Just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499, 1-888-477-WHYY. There's a lot of talk about tax reform, but from your perspective, what kind of tax reform would help savers?
Well, I think it has to be comprehensive. At this point, our tax laws reward people for borrowing, and they also reward the affluent and not the lower and middle income. So if you think about the home mortgage deduction, what does this do? Well, this tends to incentivize people to buy bigger and bigger homes, homes that probably are larger than they need. They think that they're getting a big subsidy from the U.S. government. In fact, only the most affluent taxpayers actually take advantage of this. Mm. Most homeowners have the standard deduction. In fact, don't benefit. They think they're benefiting, but they don't. So a lot of money is going toward the affluent. What I think we the same thing for retirement saving, as I said a few minutes ago. What we need to do is, first of all, we need to move away from deductions and toward tax credits. So that lower income and middle income people get a tax credit for a home mortgage, but they also get tax credits for all types of saving. Right now, at least we should start with tax credits for retirement saving. But as I say, in France, Germany, it used to be in Japan, you get tax-free small savers accounts. I think we should be starting those as well. They'd be capped at a certain level. The affluent wouldn't be able to take that much advantage of them. But we need to, in various ways, both incentivize but also signal to people that saving is very important, not just for retirement, but saving for the short term as well.
And the difference between a tax credit and a tax deduction is?
Well, a tax deduction works according to your tax bracket. Many Americans are only in the 10% or 15% bracket, so getting a tax deduction for retirement saving, they probably won't even get to that point. They'll probably get zero for it. If you give them a tax credit, you give them up front. You give them, let's say, $1,500, and that's what the affluent would get as well. In other words, it doesn't go up for the affluent. It tends to reward the people who really do need an incentive in the bottom and the middle to save. Why should we incentivize the affluent who already want to save? We need to incentivize other people.
Let me get, looks like Alicia from Newtown to join our conversation. And Alicia, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I was wanting to ask your expert whether or not he thought that the swing back to more of a culture of saving would be generational. And the reason I'm asking that question is because I'm in my early 30s, and your earlier caller that was 26 spurred this in my head. Yeah. But even when my husband and I were looking for a house before the recession hit, our realtor driving around neighborhoods in the Bucks County area was looking at some of the very big McMansions that we have all over in this region, and she was saying that those were going to be sitting white elephants someday because people of my generation didn't have an interest in living like that. So I was wondering if this move back to a more austere way of living is like a generational reaction maybe to the baby boomers that overspent and things like that.
Well, it's an interesting question. Let me see what our guest Sheldon Guerin has to say. Your thoughts?
Well, I think Alicia has a very good point. I think a new culture may set in where people realize they don't need to have super large houses. Now, I think in many ways this will be driven by necessity. I suspect most in Alicia's generation, if they had the means and they had the credit, would go for the bigger house. But I think it's becoming fairly clear that's not affordable anymore. It's much harder to get mortgages. Incomes are flat. Job situation's unstable. So I do think by necessity we may see this new, particularly in housing, this new culture of, I'm not sure austerity is the right word, but going back to reasonably sized homes, the sort of homes that have enough space but not huge spaces. In other words, we may go back more to living like a Europeans or Japanese in that respect, having good lives but just not excessive consumption.
Yeah, I scribbled down the word austere as Alicia used that, thinking that that's like being on a diet, which of course nobody wants to be on, to think that one's life is a life of austerity.
Yes, I don't think we're near that point, at least for those in middle incomes, but it may be that many middle income people will have to write down their consumption by 10% or so. I don't think it's the end of the world, but that may indeed be the reality for a while. Not that unpleasant.
But I wonder, and this goes back to what we talked about at the very beginning, which is we are told that we are an economy that depends on consumer spending. If people begin to save more, do you think that will hurt the economy or the growth of the U.S. economy?
Well, nobody's really modeled these things very well, but I don't think it's going to destroy our economy by any means. First of all, I don't think there's any danger at this point of us becoming excessive savers. We're nowhere near that point. However, I think you could say that in social and economic terms, that it would be very admirable to have more and more houses that were financially stable. This is good for society. It means that we don't have to spend as much on health care for people who don't have health insurance. It means that we don't have to spend as much on retirement for people who have no retirement saving. That having stable household finances is very good for society. And also, I think it's good for the economy in the long run, because in some ways, to spend, you got to save. Mm. And when we have so many millions of households that are over-indebted, underwater, incapable of spending, this hurts our economy. So in a sense, it might seem paradoxical, but saving is actually good for spending in the long run.
Let me get Linda from Downingtown to join our conversation. And Linda, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. Thanks
there.
For taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have to respectfully disagree a little bit with you, Sheldon, regarding these incentives that you feel that we need in order for people to save money. Because I'm honestly getting a little tired of hearing not just about, you know, rewards or incentives to get people to do responsible behavior. It's like it's a no-brainer to save money. It's a no-brainer not to put yourself in debt. This argument reminds me of a couple of years ago, everybody was jumping on McDonald's and blaming them for the obesity problem because Americans didn't know that French fries were bad for you somehow, or the same thing with health insurance companies needing to give incentives to stay in shape and to take your medicine. It seems like to me our society is dumbing down, where people don't even know that it's a dumb idea to cross the street, so let's give them an incentive to make sure they don't cross when cars are coming. I don't really understand the logic behind needing to give people incentives for this, because if we do that for one, it seems like we have to do that for every societal behavior that we deem not very healthy.
Let me take your point, because I think it's a good one. I'll be curious what our guest has to say. Sheldon Guerin, what do you say in response to Linda's comment?
Well, in a perfect world, I would agree with Linda, but there is a problem. Right now, the system is set up to incentivize spending and excessive credit. The system is also set up to make it very difficult, as I said before, for lower-income people to get bank accounts that don't penalize them so much by fees and minimum balance requirements. So we also have a system that tends, because of its deregulation, to encourage predatory lending. In other words, not giving people the information they need to make the proper choices. People will go into banks and money, at least until the last few years, would be thrown at them, money that they probably could not repay. So I would say we need to rebalance, we need to revise the system of incentives. It's already there. We need to think much more intelligently on how to foster good behavior.
Linda, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Something else that you write about in this book is about the postal savings accounts for small savers. And I scribbled this down only because we know the post offices are in trouble. Do you think there's a way to both revive the post offices but give them added responsibilities which might both save them but also allow people to use the post office as a place to save money?
That's right. I mean, and that's actually becoming a stronger recommendation in my mind. And there are various people in Washington who are also trying to encourage and to think about how we might revive postal savings. Now, we have to understand that if we look at the rest of the first world, almost every other country has a vibrant postal savings system. This started in the 19th century. It allows government, or at least government-connected postal savings services, very small savers accounts, very accessible. The post offices are everywhere. We had a system like that. It was pretty tepid from about 1911 to 1966. We let it go. But it's clear that in the rest of the first world that postal savings and postal financial services have actually been a way of reviving post offices, because everywhere in the world, including here, postal delivery revenues are way down. Right. And countries with postal savings have found it's a way of bringing back postal revenues. Postal financial services are very popular in places like Japan, France, Germany, etc. So in a sense, we could kill two birds with one stone. We could improve dramatically access to saving by lower-income households, and we also could revise the sagging post office.
And who opposes this?
Well, I think you would see if it ever got to Congress, there would be a firestorm of protest. This happened before. It happened in the 19th century in the United States. It'll happen again. The commercial banks will be up in arms at the competition. Not that the commercial banks have actually competed well for the small saver. They penalized them, but they will be up in arms. If the post office offered life insurance, as it does in Japan and other countries, the life insurance industry will be up in arms. The people who believe in small government will be up in arms. There will be a lot of opposition, but it may be an idea whose time has come.
And I'm assuming opposition with well-funded lobbyists for most of those constituencies.
You betcha, as they say in Minnesota.
Yeah, exactly. Let me get, looks like Michelle from Trenton to join our conversation. And Michelle, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi there.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I found that the easiest way for me to save is to have it directly taken out of my paycheck, just like a direct deposit, right into my savings account. I have it done through my employer with my 403B. We're a nonprofit. If I don't see it, I don't spend it. If it doesn't come to me in my paycheck, that's great, because what I get, I all spend. And it's very, very hard for me to save, actually, because, you know, it all goes out at the end of the month, you know. So the easiest way to do this is to get a direct deposit.
Well, Michelle,
right out of your paycheck.
Yeah, no, and I think a lot of people are, or a certain number of people are doing this. I'm curious, how much of, how big a percentage of your paycheck goes into savings? Do you know?
10%.
10%?
10%. Yeah, 10%.
Sheldon Barron?
It sounds like a lot, but when you think about it, you know, it's really a small amount. You know, if say your paycheck was $100, it's only $10.
Yeah.
If it's $1,000, it's $100.
Right.
You know, it could be any amount, but it is definitely a way to painlessly save.
What do you think, Sheldon Barron?
Michelle's absolutely right. The history of saving in the last 150 years shows that any time you have a system set up of regular deposits from one's pay into saving, where it becomes a regular thing, a set amount each month, a default, it works very well to promote saving. And it's something clearly, I think, if we're going to revive saving, that we have to do. The United States during World War II did this very well with payroll deductions to buy U.S. savings bonds. 27 million Americans participated in that by the end of World War II. That sort of thing by itself promotes saving more than anything else.
And 10%, is that a good target rate?
That was a target in World War II. It's probably a very good rate. I don't think our country would be in trouble if we had 10% savings.
Michelle, thanks for the call. Let's see what Andrew from California has to say. And Andrew, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
My wife and I are both educators, and prior to us, when we got married, the first 3 years of marriage, we racked up quite a bit of savings. But most of that disappeared when we paid for our house on a down payment. And then we bought our house in 2007, and then 2008, everything went to crap, and we're underwater. And on top of that, because state education budgets have been cut, my salary has been cut by 13%, my wife's by 10% over the last 3 years. And that just wiped out all of our savings. You know, we have a lot of trouble making ends meet, and we're relying more and more on credit cards. We don't want to, because I was raised from parents who had lived through the Depression and grandparents who lived through the Depression, and I remember quite clearly my grandfather telling me, don't rely on credit, buy things with cash. If you can't buy with cash, you really don't need it. And I lived that most of my life until now. Now I'm buying groceries with credit.
Oh, dear. I mean, Andrew, only because I'm looking at the clock here, and I do want to give Sheldon Garrett a chance to respond, and I appreciate the call. And, Andrew, I know you're not alone, but Sheldon Garrett, this is a disturbing phone call.
It is a very disturbing phone call, and unfortunately, it's not that rare. Yeah. Andrew is doing everything right. Saving up for a down payment is exactly what people should be doing. The timing, obviously, buying a house in 2007, not his fault, but that's what happened with the collapse of the housing bubble. People became very dependent on saving through housing, often unavoidable, sometimes avoidable, but that is what happened. And the other thing is the cut in the salaries. Of course, this goes way beyond saving, but our cuts in the public sector workers, whether laying them off or cutting their salaries, this is not a good way to stimulate an economy. And clearly, it's the wrong decision. So, I mean, he brings up a lot of good points, and we have to do something about it.
Andrew, thanks for the call to Radio Times. I sort of hate to end on that note, but we're out of time. And Sheldon Garrett, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you very much, Marty.
Nice to have you back on the show. The book is called Beyond Our Means, Why America Spends While the World Saves. He's a professor of history and East Asian studies at Princeton University. In fact, joined us from the studios of Princeton University. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can learn much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. We'll be right back.